Crime Stories with Nancy Grace.
My daddy is a hero. He helped me grow up strong. He helped me snuggle too. He reads me books. He ties my shoes. If you're a hero, blue and blue, my daddy, daddy, I love you.
You are hearing Baby Bella, just 4 years old. She was murdered by her father. That was her sitting in the back seat of the car singing. And you know what? Sometimes when I hear one of the twins or both of the twins singing, I just stop and I listen. Because I know in a couple of years, they're not going to be singing in that little voice. It sounds kind of like a fairy. It's just happy to be alive. And I'm wondering now what Chris Watts is thinking when he hears that. Because you know he's so obsessed with himself that he's listening to every shred of coverage he can get his eyes and ears on. Bella is dead along with her sister and their mother. In the last hours, we have obtained shocking audio of Chris Watts, the killer dad's confession from a Max facility in Wisconsin. Listen to this.
Like when you guys told me to take off your shirt and step check for defensive wounds, and like, you know, there wasn't going to be any. She didn't fight. I don't know why.
So she didn't grab, could she grab your arms, or were your arms pinned down? Or?
I don't remember. I don't think so. I mean, I don't think like I moved toward my knees or around her arms or anything. But it was just kind of like when I got on top of her, we started talking. That was it. It's kind of like in my head, or like in the back of my head, that was going to happen. And just like at the end of the conversation, it was just like, that's what happened. I just wish I could have let go.
Did it seem like it was that long, 2 to 4 minutes? How long did it seem for you?
Almost kind of felt like it was longer almost, because it felt like time was standing still. It's kind of like I just saw my life just disappearing before my eyes, but I just like I couldn't let go. It was like somebody else, like if you picture somebody else around you, holding your hands, holding you, keep you from not letting go.
Saw my life disappearing before me, saw my life flash before me. Wendy Patrick, veteran California prosecutor and author of Red Flags, Frenemies, Underminers, and Ruthless People on Amazon. Wendy, you know, when I would be in the midst of a trial, I didn't really have time to psychoanalyze the defendant. I mean, there were times, I would say the first 5 years that I prosecuted felonies, that I would look over and I'd wonder why would they do this? Why would they leave this wake of pain behind them with a ripple effect that will go on for generations? But to think why, but Wendy, when you really think it through, do you hear, it keeps saying me, I, my. It's all about him. He's describing the moment he was on top of his pregnant wife, Shanann, strangling her. And in the context, prosecutors asked him to take off his shirt to see if there were defensive wounds where she had maybe scratched him or hit him. He's like, no, she didn't fight back. I knew they wouldn't find anything. It's all about him. His life flashing before him. It's all about him. Did you hear that?
Yeah, Nancy, that's very troubling. And that's the kind of thing that we often see, as you know, in cases like this, where you have murderers that are explaining why they did what they did. It's from a perspective that's foreign to any of the listeners, that it is all about them and their lives and how their lives can be improved and how whatever it was that was causing conflict affected them. And so this is the decision that they made. One, I suppose, good thing about the way he's describing it is it doesn't leave much room for interpretation as to what kind of a murder this was, sadly.
No, I'm just thinking about it. Joseph Scott Morgan, forensics expert, what type of wounds do you think investigators were looking for on his body?
Well, they're looking for what are referred to as defensive wounds in the sense that Shanann is trying to fight back. Most people think of defensive wounds as the individual trying to protect himself. She's trying to scratch him, trying to do anything that she can to get him off of her. But, you know, he was kind of absent of anything, Nancy. Let's think about it. You mentioned just a second ago how she was tired. She's worn down. She's carrying a baby. She's really late in this pregnancy, Nancy. She's been on this trip, and she had other physical conditions. They've already had intimate relations. She's completely defenseless at this point in time. And then he gets on top of her. Remember, this narcissist has been working out, pumping up. He's on top of a weak, weak woman here. He's all ripped now. He takes a lot of pride in his body. He's very strong. I think that he C-clamped her throat and choked her down.
You know, it takes me back to something. Joe Scott, do you remember when we were on HLN all the time together?
Oh, yeah. Yeah, I sure do.
Okay. When I was pregnant, there were a couple of times when I would be in Atlanta and not in New York. And I would walk down, you're going to laugh. I walked to the mailbox, and walking back up the driveway, I would get so tired. I would sit down on the driveway, and there were even times, of course, I didn't know what was happening to me, that I was slowly heading toward death at that time. But I actually would lay down in the driveway. And I remember my cat Coco would come and sit with me, and I would actually lay in the driveway because I could not get up the hill. And there were many times in New York, I was carrying twins, I would have to sit down in the middle of the sidewalk, Dr. Brian Russell, to sit down on a sidewalk in New York. Where, you know, that's where everybody walks their dogs and they tee-tee and they poop and they, you know, I knew that, and I would still sit down because I could not go one more step. And I'm just thinking about what Joe Scott just said about him being all buff. As soon as he got a girlfriend, he suddenly got all buff and would take all these photos of himself without a shirt on. That's no contest, Dr. Brian.
Yeah. And I think, even beyond that, it shows you the depth of this total absence of any kind of empathy. You know, the average person feels a heightened duty to be, you know, protective and to be helpful to somebody in that state. And here's somebody who takes advantage of that to overpower the person. Again, it's a foreign idea to most people listening, but it's important to understand that this is, I'm glad that we have this confession, because it gives people a chance to hear from the horse's mouth the fact that not everybody who does this stuff is insane. You know, there are people out there, and some of them end up on juries, and some of them even end up in careers in law enforcement and as prosecutors and judges, and they actually believe that nobody does anything like this who's sane. And you can hear, this might not be a mentally healthy person. This is clearly somebody who has reached a depth of entitlement that hopefully none of us ever see in our own lives, let alone our own selves. But this is not somebody who was crazy. And it's important for people to get that, as difficult as it is to listen to.
This afternoon, my office filed formal charges against Christopher Lee Watts.
Daddy is a hero.
This is perhaps the most inhumane and vicious crime that I have handled out of the thousands of cases that I have seen.
He helps people up front.
And then he came back to the truck, and Bella had said to her father that, "You're not going to do that to me what you did to Cece, are you, Daddy?"
Shanann, Bella, Celeste, if you're out there, just come back. Like, if somebody has her, just please bring her back. I need to see everybody. I need to see everybody again. This house is not complete without anybody here. Please bring her back.
Yeah, somebody took her. That's true. But it was you, Chris Watts. You're the one that took her. In the last hours, we obtained stunning confession, audio, video
of killer dad, Chris Watts. You know, so often the public, the listener, doesn't know everything the prosecution knows. And maybe that's a good thing, because for the rest of my life, I'm going to remember the words of Chris Watts before he murdered his wife, Shanann, and their beautiful, beautiful little girls and their unborn baby boy, Nico. I'm Nancy Grace. This is Crime Stories. Thank you for being with us. In the last hours, we get that audio. Take a listen to Chris Watts in his own words.
She said, "What happened to Cece?" Same thing, the exact same thing that happened to me at CC.
Did she ask you that?
Okay.
So Bella's pretty smart. How did she sound when she asked you that?
She said that soft voice she always had.
Yeah. What exactly did she say?
She said exactly the same thing that happened to me at CC. And then I said, I don't even remember what I said. If I just said yes like a horrible person, or if I just put that blanket over her too and did the same thing.
Same blanket, same way?
Mm-hmm.
Okay.
She said no, Daddy. That's the last thing she said.
Did she say no, Daddy, like please no, Daddy type thing? Did she say a thing, don't do it?
She said no, Daddy.
Okay. Same way, hand on neck, hand over mouth, or hand over blanket, which is over mouth.
You are hearing the so-called killer dad describing his daughter, his little daughter, saying, no, no, Daddy, no. Joining me right now, an all-star panel, Joseph Scott Morgan, professor at Jacksonville State University, forensics expert and author of Blood Beneath My Feet on Amazon, felony prosecutor out of California, author of Red Flags, Frenemies, Underminers, and Ruthless People on Amazon, Dr. Brian Russell, psychologist, lawyer, host of ID's hit series Fatal Vows, author of Stop Moaning and Start Owning on Amazon, CrimeOnline.com, investigative reporter Ellen Killoran. This confession was actually taken at a Wisconsin maximum security prison, which accounts for the bad quality of it. Cops didn't take this confession so we could listen to it. This confession was taken as part of the case against a so-called killer dad, Chris Watts. Let me go to Ellen Killoran, CrimeOnline.com, investigative reporter. I want to figure out the sequence of events that night. So Shanann, his wife, who is pregnant with Nico, has been on a business trip. Her friend girl, her coworker, brings her home. She gets home after 1 a.m. from out of town. The friend drops her and leaves. Based on, if you can believe anything he says, what Chris Watts said, what happens then, Ellen?
Shanann comes home very early in the morning. She and Chris have a discussion, an emotional discussion. But then, Nancy, they also were physically intimate with each other. This is a new detail that we've learned.
Okay, wait a minute. So, hold on. Dr. Brian Russell, you're the shrink and the lawyer and the host of ID's Fatal Vows and the author. Dr. Brian, so here's a guy, Chris Watts, who's been sleeping with every skirt that walks by. He's finding people online, I mean, for one-night stands. So, but he still has enough energy to have sex with his wife when she comes home at 2 a.m. from working out of town right before he kills her. And apparently he was just about to tell her he wants a divorce, but he goes, oh, what the hey? You know, one more time around the block. So what's that, Brian Russell?
I think it's just a depth of entitlement that is hard for most people listening to relate to. Thank God it is, because this is what happens when it gets to the extreme, that somebody just feels that at any moment, taking what they want, regardless of the effect on other people, they're entitled to do it.
I'm just thinking, you know, help me out, Wendy Patrick. Maybe, no offense, Dr. Brian, but let me go to a woman on this. Dr. Wendy Patrick, if I'm about to tell somebody I want to split up, the last thing I want to do is jump in a sack. I want to get away from them. That's why I would be asking for a divorce. Well, not get closer to them.
Right. And, you know, that's one of the things that we look at when we're trying to dissect the credibility of somebody's story. And Nancy, as you and I both know in court, you know, jurors dissect it the same way you just did. Would that be the logical way you'd approach that kind of a attempted dissolution? Or was there more to the story, which it turns out may have been the case here?
Yeah. Another thing too, Joseph Scott Morgan, forensics expert and author, Joe Scott, I'm just thinking this through. I mean, she gets in, I think it's closer to 2 o'clock than 1 o'clock, been traveling all night. She's pregnant, exhausted. This wasn't a fun trip. This was a work trip. She gets in, you can see her on the video dragging her own bag in, all that. And I just find it really hard to believe that she's going to jump in the sack that exhausted. She got to get up early to take care of the children. I wonder, Joe Scott, if he thought his DNA, his sperm, was going to be found, and then he would get hit with another charge of rape.
You know, at one point in time, I listened to the tape. At one point in time, this whole intimacy thing was, it was initiated by, I believe, by her rubbing his back, is what he said in the confession. I may have that wrong.
Wait a minute. Let's stop right there. Rubbed his back. He's about to ask for a divorce. He's got the other girlfriend waiting in the wings who has already been over to his home while his wife was gone. As a matter of fact, let's hear it in his own words.
I wonder if that last time with Shanann having sex had somewhat of a role in you thinking, I got to do something. I got to say something. We got to have a talk. Something's got to change. Is that accurate?
Yeah, I felt like it was like maybe like a trigger point or something, like you hit the push button on a bomb and it just blows up.
Right.
Just something in my head was just like something, just something was hurting. Just like I had to say something.
Okay. So then exactly what did you say and what happened?
So when I woke her up and it's like, hey, we just got to talk.
Okay.
And just like I told her, I feel compatible. I don't feel like this is gonna work. I just, you know, I don't wanna, like, can we cancel a trip to Aspen? She had booked a trip that week to go to some, like, mystery four-star luxury hotel or something.
Just the two of you or the whole family?
Just me and her.
Okay.
And she had Amanda Thayer gonna watch the kids that weekend or something.
Okay.
And I was just like, can we cancel that? Can we, like, do something, like, from what I remember, I even said, can we move to Brighton? Just to get away from, like, this house.
Oh.
But, like, I'm not sure if that was, like in the beginning or the end of part of the conversation or whatnot. That conversation went so many different ways. Like, they've gone from, like, staying together to not staying together to just, like, all of the above.
Okay.
Something like you were hurting the baby or something?
That was before that, because when I was straddling her, it was kind of like around her waist type deal.
Why did you get on her like that?
I just, when we got on the bed, that's just when I got on.
Is that so she would listen to you?
I felt like she could probably listen to me just laying beside her, but I got on top of her. And every time I think about it, I'm just like, did I know I was going to do that before I got on top of her? I don't know.
That's an interesting thought, Chris.
Mm-hmm.
You don't know what you did.
Just like, everything that happened that morning, I don't know, like, I try to go back in my head, I'm just like, I didn't want to do this, but I did it.
I didn't want to, but I did. So, to Ellen Kaloran, crimeonline.com investigative reporter, it's my understanding that when Shanann Watts's parents first heard everything that he had said in this confession, they actually got sick.
Yes, Nancy, the details that we've all heard, including Shanann's family, are just absolutely harrowing. And I think that Frankie Ruzek, Shannon's brother, said it best. It's just worse than we thought.
Here is our friend, Dr. Phil, speaking with Shannon's parents.
When she had come home, there was a little bit of an argument. They went away. They supposedly were intimate. They went to sleep. He got up for work at 4 or 4:30, went downstairs. He came back up, and the argument, I guess, started all over again. Her saying that, you know, she knows he was cheating on her, to the effect of he would never see his kids again. And with that, he jumped on her, and he strangled her, wrapped her in a blanket. And with that time, Bella walked in the room and asked him what was going on with Mommy. And he said she was sick. We got to take her to the doctors. And then he took her downstairs and put her in the garage. He put her in a truck, put the two children in a truck, drove himself his 45 minutes, wherever it took him to get to the well site.
I'm so very, very sorry. And so there's a medical report now that confirms
that. Absolutely. Yes.
So we know now that the baby was alive.
Yes.
And the baby was Chris's.
Yes.
So we have three children murdered here, not two.
That's right.
And, of course, we also know, too, Joseph Scott Morgan, forensics expert at Jacksonville State University, that when Shannon was murdered or buried, she actually had coffin birth explained.
At that point in time, Nancy, her body would have decomposed to the point where the tension would have released on the baby that was containing the baby within the body, and the baby was essentially expelled into the space in which she was buried.
Okay, I'm just trying to let that sink in, what you just said. We heard our friend Dr. Phil speaking with Shannon's dad. Let's compare what he said to the killer dad, Chris Watts' own confession in a Wisconsin maximum security facility.
When she was gone, it was just like, I didn't know what was going on. It's like, it was like a traumatic, I don't know what you call it, traumatic event type, and everything, and like, I was shaking. I didn't know what had happened. I didn't know what to do. I didn't know what I had done. I still wasn't in that right state of mind. I don't think, like I was in control of what I could think or what I could do at that point in time. And most people say, like, well, I just called 911. I was like, unless you're in that situation, you don't know what you would have done. It's easy to play Monday morning quarterback.
Mm-hmm. I agree with that. That's what happened next.
Bella came in the room.
Is that what happened? Bella came in. What she said? Did she hear something? Is that what she
did? Obviously, I think.
Okay. What did you tell me?
Somebody don't feel good.
Did that happen with Bella right in that room?
Not in the front room.
What happened?
She walked in as, you know, she's talking about she was sleeping.
He says, quote, I didn't know what had happened. Well, he just strangled his pregnant wife dead. And then baby Bella comes in, asks what's wrong with Mommy. And he says, Mommy doesn't feel good. I think right there, Wendy Patrick, California prosecutor, his plan was to also murder the girls, because he takes both of them in the car to get rid of her body. What about that, Wendy?
Yeah, absolutely. And as far as who said what when, this is what he is relating after he committed all four of the murders that we've been discussing. So that credibility there is suspect also. But you're right. The fact that he had them with them really only leads to one conclusion, and that's the sad conclusion that we know occurred. It just makes the timeline make more sense logically, even though pathologically it also makes sense, because this narcissistic fueled murder spree, as described by him, this isn't something we're speculating about, really does put everyone in exactly where you would expect them to be if the multiple murder was his plan all along.
And there's no way he can now argue this was a crime of passion to get a reduced charge of voluntary manslaughter versus murder, because listen to Chris Watts, the killer dad, in his own words. Listen.
I felt like you had to.
I just felt like it was, I don't even want to say it, I felt like I had to. It just felt like there was already something in my mind that I was implanted that I was going to do it, and then I woke up that morning, it was going to happen, and I had no control of it.
You never thought about it before?
It was just like, I don't want, like in the sentencing hearing, that prosecutor said it takes 2 to 4 minutes for something like that to happen. Like, why couldn't I just let go? I didn't.
Oh, that's interesting.
just like...
Was it feeling like it was in motion and you just couldn't stop it?
Yeah, it was just like... I don't even want to know what she saw when she looked back at me, honestly.
Did you look at her? What was she doing?
She wasn't fighting.
Why do you think she wasn't fighting?
Maybe she was praying.
Praying to... Ellen Killoran, CrimeOnline.com investigative reporter. Did I hear that right? Why wasn't she fighting? Maybe she was praying? Did he just say that?
Did hear that right, Nancy. That's one of Chris Watt's explanation for what Shannon was doing, his exhausted pregnant wife, during the 2 to 4 minutes that it had to have taken for him to take her life. She wasn't fighting back. She had her eyes closed. And he thought maybe she was praying for his forgiveness, is what he said, because it's always about him.
You know, I know that there is a personality disorder. I guess it would be narcissism. You're the shrink, Dr. Brian Russell, not me. Of course, narcissism comes from Narcissus, the Greek demigod who fell in the person that fell in love with his own reflection. Narcissus. So that's not an actual insanity defense. Would you say that's what his issue is, Brian?
Narcissism is the personality trait that is at the core of every psychopath and sociopath. And so if you break down their personality, if you peel the onion, you get to the center, that's the trait that's there. That is the personality trait that gives rise to all of the other behaviors that they do, the extremity of entitlement, the depravity and absence of empathy, the inclination and the willingness to do whatever it takes, whatever they want, to get whatever feeling, whatever thing, whatever person they feel like having at the moment, regardless of the impact on other people, and to really treat other people as you and I would treat an object, a piece of property that we own, that if it tried to get up and leave us, we would feel we would feel upset because it belongs to us. And yet if we didn't want it anymore, we would toss it aside in the trash and not think about it again. That's how they think of people.
Shannon, Bella, Celeste, if you're out there, just come back. Like, if somebody has her, just please bring her back. I need to see everybody.
Did he sound worried?
No, he didn't give a flying flip. I said, Chris, I don't think you should do any media. I said, you're the last one to have seen them, so I don't think you should.
And yet he did.
I thank God he did it. I thank God in heaven that he didn't listen to me.
In that interview, Chris admits he and Shannon had exchanged words before she disappeared.
It wasn't like an argument. We had an emotional conversation, but I'll leave it at that.
In the weeks before Shannon went missing, she expressed great concern that her marriage was falling apart, sending Chris text messages like this one.
If you are done, don't love me, don't want to work this out, not happy anymore, and only staying because of kids, I need you to tell me.
I'm not just staying because of the kids. They are my light, and that will not change. I'm not sure what's in my head.
She just told me that Chris said he wasn't happy anymore, and... she didn't know what was wrong.
You're hearing our friend at ABC's Nightline, that's Amy Robach, speaking with Shannon's mom. I wonder what Bella and Celeste went through. Joining me, CrimeOnline.com investigative reporter Ellen Killoran. Ellen, what do we know?
What we know is really, really awful. What we know now is that Bella and Celeste were alive for at least an hour after Chris murdered their mother. They traveled in a truck with Chris and their mother's dead body for 45 minutes to an hour to an oil field. Bella and Celeste were sitting in the back of the truck when Chris took Shannon's body and dumped it. Bella was sitting next to her little sister when Chris Watts strangled Celeste, or Fifi, as her family called her. And she was still alive when Chris Watts put Cece into an oil tank. And then she said to her father, is the same thing going to happen to me? It's just, and it did.
Just so hard for me to take in that evil. We also are learning that Chris Watts goes to great pains to deny he's having an affair with a gay escort. Now a second man claiming to have had a relationship with him after meeting in rehab. He's going to great efforts to go, no, I've never been with a man. You know, that is the least of his concerns. Why is he so concerned about that, Dr. Brian Russell? Who cares who he had an affair with? I care about Shanann and Bella and Celeste. I don't care who he was with. I care about the fact he murdered them. And he's so worried about what people may think of him sexually.
Well, yeah, again, I think it's a nice illustration. I mean, it's sad, but it's a good illustration of the fact that he's concerned about how he's coming off in the story in a way that he apparently thinks is would be degrading to him as a man or whatever. If it weren't so sad, it would almost be comical that he's concerned about how he comes off in that regard, and yet we're talking about the murders of his wife and children.
You know, I'm thinking a lot about what E.K. Ellen Caloran was talking about, what Bella and Celeste endured, riding along for up to an hour with their mom's dead body after she had defecated all over the sheets. She was dead, wrapped up in the bed sheets, in the car with them as they drove an hour to the Anadarko oil fields. Take a listen to our friend Dr. Phil with Shanann's parents.
And then he came back to the truck, and Bella had said to her father that, "You're not going to do that to me what you did to Cece, are you, Daddy?"
Bella was still in the back of the truck alive. Okay. Tell me what happened there.
She said what happened to Cece. First, she asked, it's the same thing, the exact same thing that happened to me as Cece.
And then he took her life.
It's worse than we even thought. We thought the worst was what we heard already. You know, we had no idea it was way worse than this.
I'm so very, very sorry. Well, as a grandfather, I can't imagine.
Those are my grandchildren. I love them. They were mine. I cry all the time. There's many times that I just feel like giving up. If it wasn't for God, I wouldn't be here.
You hear Shanann's family crying in tears as they speak to Dr. Phil. Back to Chris Watts, the killer dad. We're getting a look inside of his brain. Take a listen to this.
You know, I look outside every day. I'm like, what could we be doing right now? You know, right now I have a 5-year-old, a 3-year-old, and one might be a 1-month-old son. And a beautiful wife. And just like, right now it's just me.
Me. I could have had a son. I could have had these children. I could have had a beautiful wife. It's all about him, Wendy Patrick, again.
Yeah, I'll tell you what, Nancy, this really is one of those things where the consistency with this narcissistic trait is almost stunning. There so far hasn't been anything about remorse, about, gosh, I wish that I didn't put them through it. I mean, an hour drive for those girls, as you pointed out, with their mother's body in the back. I mean, that alone is almost stunning in terms of just the emotional confusion and terror and trauma. I mean, to not even have thought what he put everybody else through, it really is stunning.
You know, to you, Joseph Scott Morgan, professor of forensics at Jacksonville State University and author, Joe Scott, why is it so important that we know the timeline, that we know the facts as fully as possible? Because bottom line, we know Chris Watts murdered his wife, his two little girls, his unborn son. We know that. So why is it critical that we can develop this timeline and the facts?
Well, you have to be able to pair these things up and marry them up relative to the sequence of how this all went down. Looking at all of this in totality, one of the things I have a major problem with, I've had people in the media that have come to me, I've had people just, you know, in the general public that have tried to, I don't know, alibi or give some reason for why Chris Watts did what he did. The big problem I have here is they say that, well, it was a spontaneous event that he killed his wife. No, that all of that aside, I have to say that this is something that he had planned for a protracted period of time. He was just waiting for the right time to trigger. He knew specifically what it was like to take the life of his wife. It was a visceral event. He was on top of her. He choked her out. Now, he puts the body in the truck. He has a window, 45 minutes to 55 minutes, to think all of this through his mind, to put this in the process, to get out to those oil fields, at which time he could have said, he calls No Joy and says, hey, I'm not going to do this any longer. I'm going to throw my hands up and let these children live. He decided not to. He premeditated this event, got them out there, and killed them after they arrived at the oil fields.
And also, Dr. Brian Russell, host of ID's Fatal Vows, the reality is that under the law, intent, premeditation can be formed in a twinkling of the eye.
You could do that in a heartbeat. Another thing I think is interesting about this is when you listen to this confession, it does not sound like the person giving it is having a hard time giving. It doesn't even sound very difficult or really difficult at all for him to tell this story. You know, it almost sounds like he is, he's in a situation now where, you know, he doesn't really have any hope left of living the life that he was trying to create for himself by committing these crimes. And so the way to sort of keep himself the center of attention, to sort of, keep the spotlight on him, is to tell this story. And it almost sounds to me like at some points he's sort of enjoying the way that he sort of matter-of-factly relates this and probably, you know, looks into the eyes of the questioners and sees the shock, sees the shock value that he's delivering, and taking some kind of a pleasure in that. It's awful. It's just a depth of evil that I hope nobody listening ever sees in their own life.
Hey, Nancy, one other point, if I could make it. Out of all these victims, Bella, she's the one that questions him at the oil field, according to what he's saying. And in addition to that, out of all of these, she is the one that is demonstrating through what remains of her body that she fought back. She had some horrific injuries to her mouth. She struggled with her dad as he's placing this blanket over her face. He's holding his hand over the blanket and cutting off her airway. She fought back in the midst of this horrible, horrible, just tragedy that's going on. And still, he didn't have the depth to show mercy in all of this.
Our prayers with the family of Shanann. Nancy Grace, Crime Story, signing off. Goodbye, friend.